This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention that everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast podcast, a show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry. Today, I'm speaking with ex-radio boss man and the managing director of Brown Street Media, Louis Villasoni Oliver. For nearly two decades, Louis has been a constant voice and driving force behind Pacific Media in New Zealand, from humble beginnings cutting audio in the news studios at just 17 to hosting his own night show, to eventually stepping into leadership as program director. Louis' journey has been defined by persistence, community, and a deep love for championing Pacific stories and voices. He's interviewed global stars, helped break local talent, and also, most recently, launched his own media company. Welcome to the show, Louis.
Jamie, thanks for having me, man. Great intro, too.
Oh, mate, the intro serves yourself, mate. You've done so much in such a short amount of time, and I feel like you're going to keep doing more great stuff. And we can start from the beginning, mate. You started your radio journey at just 17 with the help of your auntie.
Yep.
Back in 2003.
Yep.
Now, what do you remember the most from those first few times that you bravely jumped behind the mic?
Man, when I jumped behind the mic, I didn't know. When I was first introduced to the radio scene at that age, I didn't know that radio was a thing. Like, I would listen to the radio, you know, as a teenager in the car, but it just didn't click to me that this was a job or this was a profession. So when I first jumped behind the mic, super nervous as you were, but I felt really comfortable early on when I done that first stint. I mean, I'd done a whole bunch of interning in that before I got on the mic, but ever since the first time I jumped on the mic, it just felt comfortable.
And you mentioned in an earlier interview that Fuatuma Lesa Tago was the first person that you saw when you stepped into the new FM studios, and that for a while you were cutting up audio for him, which was mostly Samoan gospel audio, despite you not even speaking the language. Looking back, like, how funny of an experience was that for you, kind of like as your first jumping in point into radio, cutting up audio, but actually not understanding the language that you're cutting up the audio for?
It was really crazy. I've always had this thing with me where I'm naturally a fast learner with things, whatever I do get into. So as overwhelming as it was to cut up audio from a language that I didn't understand, and I can't really explain this, but it also came naturally to me, and I sort of knew what to do, where to cut, to an extent. But these things, they've happened to me quite a bit over my career where I would just jump into it and it would just come naturally to me. But yeah, I had no idea what the language was talking about. But I was also having fun too, just knowing like, oh man, this is cool. I'm getting to do this and like this is a real thing. And so yeah, that all made up for it.
Is it kind of like that whole feeling of being given the keys to the car and just being letting, like, going rip and being like, you know what, I finally get to get myself behind the wheel?
100%. It's totally that feeling. And it makes you feel so cool too, especially at that age. Like, I used to think to myself, man, none of my friends are doing this. This is just me.
And the very first time you jumped behind the mic was actually a weekend show, which was with Nate, which now has become like a long-term partner of yours in terms of media. Is it kind of funny looking back that relationship is where it is now from just that first moment of you jumping on air?
Man, I think about it all the time. It would have been, I think, 2005 maybe. So Nate and there was another guy on there, his name was Jono. He was the assistant program director of New FM at the time. They hosted, or they were doing an old school radio show on a Saturday afternoon, and that was my first time just sort of being amongst it. And what they'd done is they said, oh, we got to go and do this thing. Can you just, you know, watch the thing? So they left me in there cold turkey, and I had to, you know, sort of just jump in and do it. But yeah, man, it's crazy. I talked to Nate about it. Like, I've known Nate, you know, what is that, 20 years now, 20 plus years. So it is really crazy to think about our relationship now. And I mean, it's a brotherhood. And yeah, me and Nate just run into each other all the time over the years.
And was there some early lessons that you learned from those first couple of years? Because around 2005 as well, you were attending radio school. Was it kind of like you were educating yourself from the university, kind of like past high school perspective as well, but also learning on the job?
Yeah.
Do you feel like there was a lot more that you learned on the job than compared to the education in radio school that could have been taught in that?
Yes. So yes, I did feel like working on the job helped me learn a lot. But the flip side was it gave you a little bit of an ego too. So I sort of had this know-it-all attitude when I was at the radio school, because, you know, I'd be like, man, I'm already working at the radio station. I already know this. I already know that. And I got in trouble one time at the radio school for loading music into the music logs, because they have example radio stations or pretend radio stations. And I took it upon myself to just go and load a few songs that I wanted to hear. And I got in trouble for that. But that was my ego at the time, man. It was crazy. But definitely learned more working on the job.
I'm curious, what was the playout system that you were using at radio school? And was it the same one that you were using at New?
It was at the time. So it was RCA Selector, I believe it was, or Master Control. One of those two. So that was the program back then. And because I had been doing it at New FM, because they were using the same program, so I, again, went to the radio school. I was like, I know this. I know how to do this. And then I went and chucked in my songs. And it was the Yin Yang Twins' Whisper. Terrible song. Terrible song.
Absolute banger, mate. How do you think you got caught out? Do you think someone snitched on you, or do you think it was them noticing that the Yin Yang Twins were randomly in there amongst all the like New Zealand classics?
Nah, it was definitely that they noticed Yin Yang Twins was in a it was the Kiwi Classics radio station. So it was like, Yin Yang Twins is not a Kiwi classic. What the hell happened?
And there's some stuff that you mentioned in a lot of other interviews where you talked about the importance of being available, and a lot of the opportunities for you that came from New later on was from the fact that you made yourself available, you were covering shifts, you're filling in for other people. Do you think that that work ethic that you established really early on is what kind of pushed you to where you are today?
I think so. I do tell people that all the time. In my early stages at New FM, I think I went 3 whole years covering every single public holiday, covering every single person who ended up being sick. And I noticed that when you sort of, you know, give that, you give that attitude and you show like the PDs or the CDs at the time, they say, oh man, he's reliable. If somebody doesn't turn up for the shift, we can just call Louis. And that really worked out for me, because yeah, over that amount of time doing that, it sort of just really cemented me in the whole workplace, and I became known as, you know, the call-on guy. So yeah, I do think making yourself available and being committed to the cause, to your drive, really works. So yeah.
And is this still something that you still see and you hope that you see in a lot of people that end up working with you or under you in a sense? Like team members from when during your time at program director at New FM?
Yeah.
Is that kind of the same expectation you set for a lot of staff members, or is it something that you're kind of like, I know I'm like this and I can't expect other people to be like this? But, or is there a little bit of like, come on, man, like put some skin in the game?
Good question. It's somewhere in the middle for me. So yes, I did always keep with me that, you know, that was a me thing, and I didn't want to, you know, put that on every single person. But what was cool is that with a lot of the young hosts that I came across, or who came across New FM over the last couple of years, it makes you really notice who's who and what's what. So there were probably two to five staff that have, you know, come across me over at New FM, and they had that same ethic. And it only cemented to me that that attitude is the right way, because I would look at them and be like, yeah, that's the one. It's like, yeah, that's great attitude. And they always want to be a part. So I just found myself feeling like I could rely on them for that. So, and then there's the flip side, you know, there's other hosts who came with an ego and thought they could come and voice track a show and disappear. And I was like, ah, that's not the way, man.
I'm curious, because you've mentioned ego twice now, and I feel like ego is naturally a thing that comes in the media industry. And do you think that's something that a lot of people really have to taper down from even the early beginnings, even to later down the track? Because you do have these presenters and hosts who have been in the game for a long time, so they naturally have an ego just based on the fact that, especially in New Zealand, radio hosts are celebrities, unlike probably in a lot of other countries where it's a little bit more tapered back. Do you think that's kind of a skill or something that people have to really think about when they do get into this industry, to acknowledge maybe when they are being too overconfident or when their ego is affecting their kind of abilities?
Yes, I do think so. And it is a skill. And it's an interesting dynamic, and especially if I think about it, because you're right. And when some of the radio hosts who are here in New Zealand at the moment and have been in the industry for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, and they've been putting in the work, and they have an ego, and I sort of look at them and I'm like, you know what? I understand. And I guess you kind of deserve an ego, because, you know, you've been putting in the work. The ones who come with an ego early, yeah, those are the red flags. So I'll say is I definitely understand the ego thing, but yeah, it's a real skill to understand that you have an ego, when to try and tame your ego, and also when to let your ego shine, because sometimes it works out, and that's what people love sometimes when listening to the radio.
A common theme I've seen with a lot of people is the idea that there is a radio voice or radio personality in terms of how they present themselves. Is that something that you thought about quite early on, Louis, when you were doing a lot more on-air work?
Yes, it was. When I first got into radio, I did think that the radio voice was, you know, the all-important tool that you needed to have. The longer I was in the industry and the more I learned that that really wasn't the case. So I definitely learned and switched up over the years. And now my thing is definitely not about the voice. It's all about the communication. It's all about the articulation and definitely about the personality.
And do you think your personality has developed over time from that as well? Even from the sake of you moving into more management roles, that like you develop a personality as to how you work with other talent to help them kind of shine as well?
Yeah. I think so, yes. With me though, the older that I've gotten and the longer that I was in the industry, my personality started to change, but it started to go the other way. Like I started to be less confident. And I started to not want to be in front of the mic and not wanted to be in front of the camera anymore. And I became real, real timid and reserved. So yeah, I always think about that stuff, cause I think it was really interesting for me, cause I did have the ego and I did have the confidence back then. But it changed, I don't know, maybe halfway through my career, but I think it did help with helping the younger hosts sort of build their confidence, because I was always like the real chilled, happy to listen, happy to watch you shine kind of boss. And that really encouraged a lot of the young hosts that came across my desk or my studio. So, yeah.
And it's interesting you mentioned that pivot as well, because you had a pivot early on, which a lot of people would be surprised about the fact that you did this kind of U-turn and went to My FM.
Yeah.
You hosted The Drive Show, yeah, which is kind of going in a completely different direction from New, which has its own audience, and then My, which is like a behemoth of commercial radio. And How did you find that move to Maya? Was it kind of a bit scary? And what was the decision behind that? And how did that shape your perspective on kind of like what radio is? Because you moved over there with Nate around the same time, didn't you?
Yeah, it was about maybe one or two years after Nate got there. That was a pivotal time for me in my career. So at the time, and it was definitely through Nate. So it was a real interesting story and a real cool story that I've only told a few people about how that happened. So before Nate went over to Mai, he asked me, I had to cut up a Skype tape for him because Mai FM wanted to listen before he got hired. So I cut it up for him. And I was like, man, Nate, you're probably going to get this. And I said to him, man, if you go over, can you take me with you? So when Nate ended up at Mai, I think it was there, like I said, maybe 1 or 2 years. And he suggested my name to DJ Severe at the time, who was looking for someone. This is the time when Nate left the afternoons and went to the mornings, which left that afternoon slot available. So Nate, he suggested me to DJ Severe and met with DJ Severe, met with Leon Ratt over at MediaWorks, and they liked me, they liked what they heard, so went over to Mai. Definitely very scary because, yeah, moving from this community station and this community feel and this Pacific Island focused thing that I was doing at New FM, and knowing now that I'm going to this national behemoth, like you said, and Mai FM was the cool station to be at, and all eyes and all ears are on it. Definitely scary, but man, I got comfortable there after the first month or two. It just felt like home again. So yeah, it didn't take me long to fit into Mai.
It's kind of like the feeling of moving away from home, going from new to Mai FM. It's kind of like, oh, I don't want to leave my friends and family. Or it's like kind of like leaving high school. You're like, oh, what's going to happen to all my friends? But you found your place.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah. I'd liken it definitely to leaving high school and leaving all your friends that you've known for so long and your place of comfort and going into this brand new job, like just like a high school student would start their new job, new career, and everything's cool and everything's new and everything's, it's all bright lights and the pace is fast. And so that's how I liken it to, but real fun. Got so much love from the Mai family.
Did you ever get like a similar sort of mark to what I've heard is the mark at Wesley College, the WTC? Did you ever end up getting some Mai FM ink to kind of remember the time there?
No, I haven't. Like I said, man, I think when I was talking about how my personality started to change, it started to happen when I was at Mai. Because I might have been 26. 25, 26, maybe around that time. And then I started to think, and here's a funny fact. I started to think that I was getting too old for Mai FM by that time. And my co-host, my co-host at the time, her name was Haley. She was, I think she was early 20s, 21, 22 maybe. And she was into the clubbing scene.
Haley Crook?
Haley Crooks, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, nice. So she was my co-host. And so I would think, I'd be like, man, I think I better wrap it up. I'm getting too old here. I got sidetracked with that question a bit. Sorry, man.
No, but I think that's the interesting thing, because you look at Mai now and the general kind of hosts and presenters that are on there now, a lot of them are probably a lot older than what you described as 26, or like the lifetime of a radio host in New Zealand extends to sometimes even 40. And you're like, wait, these guys were on the pop hit station that most 20-year-olds are listening to, and they're in their like 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
Why do you think that kind of freaked you out a little bit?
Maybe it was just sort of more personal things and things that were going on in my life. And you know, I was dad at the time, and I had two young girls at the time, and I kind of felt like my life and my lifestyle that was happening outside of the radio, I was feeling like that wasn't really fitting the Mai FM lifestyle and what the Mai FM lifestyle should be. So I think it was those kind of thoughts that, I don't know, sort of tripped me up or made me think about things a bit more deeper
because do you feel there's a bit of an image that you need to maintain, like you need to be going out to these like parties or going to these hip hop shows all the time, whereas like your kind of weekend activity was maybe chilling out with the missus and like, I don't know, going down to the football fields and playing with the kids kind of thing?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was definitely that. I felt like, yeah, I didn't have the cool clothes. I wasn't going out to the cool clubs, and I couldn't afford to go to all the cool holidays that, you know, all the young kids were. That's how I was feeling at the time. I look back at it now, and I think, you know, I shouldn't have thought that deeply about it, but it was definitely something that was on my mind quite a bit when I was at MI.
And that's interesting, because it's the same sort of thing now. You're looking at radio presenters now, or people that are working in media, they're a little bit more, I guess, transparent about not putting up this kind of like false image of what they're like all the time. Like, I've noticed, especially in the last 5 years, a lot of people have been like, oh, you know, like, everyone assumes I'm this big larger-than-life character, but actually I'm shy outside of the studio. Like, I'm just this character inside of here, but completely different. Is that kind of like where you feel like it would have been nice to have someone tell you that and be like, you don't have to put up this like identity all the time. Like, you can just be Louis, not like Louis goes to the club and goes out wild.
Yeah. I think it would have definitely helped if, you know, people would have given me encouragement like that. But I think the flip side to that, like, I don't think anybody was thinking like that about me either. I think that was just a me thing, and I was just getting into my feels a lot. So, yeah, I don't know, man. But I think, yeah, if someone would say, hey, man, just be yourself. And I think they did a few times too, but it's kind of like, oh, yeah, I'll be myself. But really, it's like, nah, man, I gotta be on. I gotta be up.
You went from my, but then you went back to new. And the way you've always put it is you fell into being a program director. How did that conversation come about? Was it you were already making moves or making plans to go back to new, and then the position kind of opened up? Or was it something that you were kind of groomed into coming into? They were like, oh, we really hope that Louis comes back. He's been here for years. He knows his stuff. Like, he'd be the perfect candidate. What was the kind of the situation that happened there?
It was definitely falling into it. So the real reason why I left my and came back to new was during my later years at my, I talked to DJ Severe at the time, and I said, oh, I don't know if I want to do the on-air thing for much longer. And I asked specifically if there were any, you know, off-air jobs that they could move me to, if there's anything that I could do that's off the mic, which there weren't. And Maya was a small team at the time as well, so I understood it. And around that time, I got an email from I got a text message from one of my friends who was still at New FM. They were like, oh, hey, you know, you want to catch up? That led to me coming back to be an audio engineer at first, because they had to let go the audio engineer who was here at New FM at the time. And they messaged me, and it was sort of like a timing thing, because they emailed me or they texted me during the time that I was, you know, feeling like I wanted to come off the mic and wanted to do behind the scenes stuff. And then that message came through. So I was like, oh, okay. So I had a chat. You know, the money was a little bit better. It wasn't great, but a little bit better. So I ended up coming here being an audio engineer first, which I loved. I loved that job because I got my own studio and you know, closed door soundproof. It was beautiful. I fell into the program director job because at the time, Nadia Marsh was the PD for New FM when I came back, and she sort of had a difficult time, and she ended up leaving, and there was nobody else who could quickly fill that spot that sort of knew the go, and also had the strong thing that I had was I had the ear of the staff, and they would tell me this all the time, because all the staff would either come to me and either confess things to me or ask advice from me. So I was kind of like the natural go-to. So when Nadia Marsh ended up leaving, I fell into it as an interim kind of thing. And then they opened it up for applications. I applied, and then I got it.
it's crazy, man, because it's almost from that background of you covering for all the shifts that people just got to know your face, got to know you around, and they probably would have just naturally assumed, oh, no, Louis, he's just a manager here anyway.
That's like, crazy, Jamie.
He knows all the technical stuff.
When you put it like that, holy crap, yes. It's definitely that again.
It's yeah, because I feel like that was always naturally going to happen to you. And I think the thing that makes it even funnier is I think you've mentioned before in a chat that you had on another podcast that you never felt like you were a natural manager.
And I still don't.
Do you feel like that made you a better team leader because you never felt like you were a manager? You were just everyone's kind of mate. You were just kind of around.
Crazy. Yes, I do. Management was never anything that I aspired to be. I never had it in my plan to be like, man, I want to be the boss. I want to manage this radio station. It was never that for me. But when you say that, yes, because after doing the management thing for 5 to 6 years, I really feel like that style of management was or is the best style for people, because I always think about, man, if I had a boss, like I would want the boss to just be natural with me as well. And I would want the boss to talk to me, not at me and on my level. So yeah, man, I think that really played favor to my management style. The flip side is everybody though, they think that they can walk over you and they can misbehave. They'd be like, nah, Louis is all good. Louis is all good. So that's the flip side of it.
So it's kind of like open door policy, but then also the naughty kids, like it's kind of like the high school where they like know that they can get away with it with the substitute teacher. They're like, oh, yeah, sir, you can play the movie and nothing else.
Absolutely.
No, we didn't have any homework.
Absolutely that. Yeah. But the general thing for me is I still stand by that type of style of management and you know, being ground level with the people because, you know, I think that if the staff sort of have that understanding with you, then they wouldn't want to disrespect you or they wouldn't want to do all the mischievous stuff anyway because of, you know, the relationship that they'd have with me or the manager. So I stand by it, man. I like it.
Sort of like by being that authoritative figure, it actually creates more distance between you and the employee like you said, having that closer relationship, there feels like there's a bit more to lose if they make a mistake or if there's, well, not even making a mistake, but if they do something that goes against kind of that relationship that you have.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that helps with performance and especially in the radio scene. I think that, you know, if the staff and the audio hosts feel like they have that genuine support system from a boss, then I think that they just carry that confidence and carry that over to the mic, and then it just, you know, comes out on the station and it benefits everybody.
Do you think that's why New FM has been such a springboard for so many Pacific people entering media? Because there has been that kind of support around trying to build up like people's voices and get them on air and get them working and get them out in media. And I'm curious as well, do you think that New still plays that important role in building up Pacific voices in media?
Yes, I do. Yes, and yes. So yeah, I think it's always been a strong point of New FM and Pacific Media Network. And not to take away that, you know, we have these Pacific people who are just talented, but the whole ethos of what New FM and Pacific Media have been and still is, you know, we're here in the field. If you're a talented Pacific person who really loves this media stuff, come over here, come and work for us, come and shine bright. And if you decide you want to take a step up or step out, then man, we support you. This is what it's all about, because we're essentially sending our brown soldiers into the field, you know, after us. So I think it still happens today. Probably not to the extent that it happened back in the early 2000s, but I think because times are different now too, with social media and internet stuff, like I think that those are the springboards now, but New FM still has its part to play.
And we'll also talk about the early 2000s, because for a lot of people that know anything about the early 2000s, particularly in music, that was like the dawn and the rise, and I'll use dawn because of Dawn Rage, that Pacific music was just absolutely massive. Was it kind of strange for you entering at that time and being like, oh, like I'm seeing my own people like absolutely killing it on like the international stage.
It was interesting. It was actually unbelievable to me. So when I first started and in those early 2000s years, and let's say for example, let's talk about Mareko, and Savage and the whole Dawn Raid thing when they were like in New York City, and when Savage had a song with Akon and P Money was doing stuff with Akon, it was just like, what the hell? Like, is this even real? It was just so unbelievable for me. But yeah, it was a great feeling. I wasn't as strong a supporter of the Pacific music scene as I am today, but I guess that came more from maybe just ignorance, because it was just there, and I was just, you know, listening to the music, and I was cool in that. But definitely, around those, when Pacific music was really popping, it was just like an unbelievable thing for me. I was like, wow.
I think even for my missus, who's from Argentina, I'm based here in Latin America, and even she knows who Savage is. That's when I know, like, it's big. It's like, wait, Latin Americans are listening to this? They know what this is? Oh, this is awesome. Yeah.
Man, Savage, yeah, he's one of the goats, all right, and there's a few out there. That's New FM alumni too.
And that's the way. And New FM was, this is the thing I still find crazy, that New FM was one of only 8 stations that was recognized when New Zealand Air for playing over 20% local music. Now, I studied this when I was at university. I went to broadcasting school and I did a particular paper on the fact that there wasn't enough local music being played. And you guys were smashing those records all the time.
Yeah.
Now, why is it that you guys made it such a priority to champion not only Pacifica artists, but just New Zealand music in general? Was that like a personal priority for you, or is it something that you just felt like was the right thing to do?
I felt like it was a bit of a mix of things. I felt like it was the right thing to do. I felt like it was just on brand for us. I thought, you know, a lot of the conversations that I used to have at New FM with either management or the on-air staff was, you know, we're in this interesting pocket. New FM's in this interesting pocket where, you know, we share and fight the audience of My FM and Flavor. So with these conversations, we talk about, man, you know, My FM's playing this stuff, but we're playing this stuff. Flavor's playing this stuff, and we kind of play this stuff too. So I thought, you know what My FM and Flavor can't play? They can't play, first off, it was language music. So they can't play language music. So let's make that our thing. And it just so happened that the New Zealand Pacific music industry at the time was just really bubbling, and it was really upgrading, and it was really getting better. So it was pretty timely for us. So I, as program director, my thing was then, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to, if Mai's playing all the new cool music, we can still play that. And Flavor's going hard with old school music now, we can still play that. But you know what they can't play? They can't play Jam or Jam, but that's still cool. And they can't play Pacific Soul, but we can play Pacific Soul. And that was sort of the mentality. So I wouldn't say it was a priority. It was more of a strategy, to be honest, Jamie, and was just trying to really find our way amongst the My FM beast and the Flavor beast. And yeah, it worked out.
It did work out, yeah, because you guys were championing some seriously good artists, and a lot of people rate you guys as being the reason that like a lot of people are getting those voices. And would you like to see more representation for Pacific music in the general sphere rather than it falling just solely to New? Because like you said, My FM is playing a little bit of that music, Flavor is as well, but New was always going to be the ones championing it. Would you like to see that spread a bit further outside New Zealand, or you're like, nah, those guys should have their little pocket. They should keep that. That's their thing.
That's a gift and a curse there, Jamie. I would love to see the Pacific music everywhere. And, you know, My FM these days, they're doing pretty good too. Like, they're playing people like Shane Walker is a name that comes to mind, because he's pretty hot at the moment. He's Cook Islands singer, rapper, and people like Kenyon Brown and Donnell Lewis, who I thought that My FM would never really play you know, 5-10 years ago. Now they're on top of it. And so it's bittersweet because it's like, shit, that's cool. And it was like, damn it, now we're going to have to find a new pocket to get some more audience. But all in all, I just want the Pacific music and the Pacific artists to be out there. And I swear, they are just as good, if not better, than, you know, the 660s that are out there, the LABs, Stan Walkers. Like, we need to be in that same discussion. We need, because we're on par. I believe so anyway.
Do you think there's also like a changing narrative of like the classic thing? And this is what I usually hear from a lot of people when they talk about the idea of New Zealand music is like, oh yeah, I love it because it kind of sounds like something from the US, or I kind of like it because it sounds like something from the UK or whatever. Do you think that's slowly changing now and there's not this association of like, oh, it's good because it sounds like this? It's just, it's good because it's good.
I do think that narrative is changing. I think it is going away because, it's kind of normalized now that, when Pacific music comes out, I don't really hear that comparison anymore. Cause you're right. I did used to hear people say, like, oh man, this is mean. Cause it sounds like, man, it sounds like Chris Brown. Oh, sounds like Trey Songz or whatever. But now it's just like, you know, the understanding is there now. That's like, man, this is just a good song. So, yeah, these days are good with that.
And you were heavily involved with another project, which was Wave.Room, which was kind of like a live streaming sort of setup that you guys had, very much in the vein of those like studio sessions that a lot of other like kind of up and coming media companies were running. There was a big one actually here in Latin America, which was like, geez, what the hell is his name? Anyway, did a collab with Shakira. But anyway, totally off topic.
Yeah.
But the thing I love is the fact that you were getting involved in that. And what was it that made you think I need to get more into the digital space than the traditional just terrestrial radio space? What was it that made you make that decision to be like, I'm going to go down this avenue as well and see what happens here?
I'm that type of person where I always want to be doing something new and something different. No matter how small or big, I'm always thinking about, okay, cool. Now that we've done this, now we've done the radio thing. Cool. We've had these cool segments, whatever. I say, man, I want to do. We need to do something different. Otherwise, it's going to get boring for audience and for myself. So that's a big driving factor for me. In my career is just always wanting to do something different, no matter how big or small. So that's how I got into the Wave Room thing. We had the space. It needed to be. It needed some upgrading because at the time it was just the space. So we made an effort, and it was a team effort too. We had our digital team at the time, and Tony Sock and Kevin and Samson and Bryson, and we sort of got together and said, "Man, let's do this." And this is when like Colors was a really big thing. I mean, Colors is still
that
a big.
That was what I was thinking of, Colors.
Yeah, yeah. So Colors was like the cool thing at the time. And Tiny Desk was a thing too. And we thought, man, what can we do that is similar to this or like this? And that's how we came up with the Wave Room stuff. We said, man, we got this big space here. Let's do our own live performances and not just box it into live performances. Maybe we can do stand up comedy shows here. Maybe we can do dance routines here or whatever. So that's how we got into the Wave Room stuff. It was stink though, because when we really finished the Wave Room stuff and then COVID happened, and then that sort of threw things out of whack. Then we didn't have any furniture and then when we came back, it was just a mess.
I think that's the thing that I love about you, Louis, is you're always experimenting. You're always trying to find something new and find a new way to kind of be like, okay, how can we like make use of the fact that we've got like a smaller team, but do something like impactful in that way? I think that's the thing I always found interesting about just looking at your career alone, is that you managed to find ways of utilizing the kind of tools that you have to make something fresh, which is like really, really impressive. And that leads to what I think is the most impressive thing, which is you starting Brown Street Media. Was it always your dream to kind of have your own like media company, your own thing? Or was this something that like kind of slowly started to happen and then you're like, you know what, I'm just going to take the leap of faith and see what happens?
Again, it was kind of one of those things that fell into my world. Here, so I got to give a lot of credit to Nate on this one. I around maybe 2022, 2023 maybe, I started looking at podcasting as the new radio, and it being, you know, really a thing. Because I've been a podcast fan. I think I've been on to podcasts 2015, maybe 2014, 2015. I started to think, okay, how can I pivot myself and my career into podcasting? And I even tried a few things. I tried to get to iHeartMedia. They had some things going over there with their podcast thing, and that didn't really work out. I caught up with Nate one afternoon, just because we hadn't seen each other for a while. He had gone through, you know, his things that he went through. I owed him a coffee. So, you know, I messaged him. I said, come on, man, it's been almost a year. Let's go and have a coffee or whatnot. We had a coffee. He told me, he said, my FM want me to go back, but I want to do a podcast, me and Nixon. And I said, oh shit, that's a mean idea. I said, man, I've been wanting to get into the podcasting thing too, but it's not clicking. So he said, we're gonna record a pilot. He said, you want to jump on board as a producer at the time? I said, hell yeah. So we done the pilot. We done a little teaser for it, and you know, people were just so happy to have Nixon and Nate back together, because the Nixon and Nate brand from the MyFM days is so strong. So when we released the podcast and we had this momentum happening with the podcast, and I felt like, okay, yeah, this is the progression here. This is my natural, you know, out. I want to do this and I want to build this. It doesn't have to be just Nixon and Nate. I want a podcast for music. I want a podcast for news. I want to start a podcast for sports. So that's where the Brown Street Media thing came from. And here's something ironic too. So Brown Street Media is actually named after Brown Street in Ponsonby in Auckland City, because that's where the old New FM station was at, where me, Nixon, and Nate met each other. So that's where the Brown Street name comes from.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, mate, because I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, because I know some people, they might look and say, oh, is it because he's a brown? I mean, that is just a bonus, but it's named after the street that the New FM studio was on, early 2000s, and that was the place where I met Nate, and where Nate met Nixon, and Nixon met me. So it was kind of natural. It's like, oh, that kind of makes sense. So Brown Street Media it is.
It's cool you had that light bulb moment. And I think you touched on something really interesting, which was the power of Nixon and Nate as a power combo. And that, like, it transcended radio, that their kind of relationship can be taken onto many different medias and still work because of the fact that they have this sort of relationship. Was it kind of during that first pilot that you're like already immediately thinking like, shit, this is just happening. This is just working. Like, this is going to be awesome. Like, I can see this running for a year, 2 years, 3 years.
Yep. It was that from very early on. I mean, I was excited from when Nate was talking to me about the idea. And when he was talking to me about the idea, it was funny because when he told me, I thought, oh man, it's such a cool idea. But I was like, I wonder if you're going to do it or not. Well, this is just talk. So yeah, once we got onto things, yeah, first episode, and just to see the impact that it had with people, I was like, yeah, man, I want to be in this podcasting thing. And it's fun. It's fun too.
And looking back, because you've clocked now about 20 years in media, when you look back, what do you think is the thing that still surprises you the most when you're looking back at your journey, your career and everything else? Is there anything that you kind of look back on and you're like, geez, I can't believe I've done that?
You know what? It's definitely being the drive host on MyFM. It's definitely that. Like, because I look at how MyFM is today, and like their numbers are outstanding. They're just insane. and everybody knows MyFM. It's just an annoying truth that everybody knows and loves MyFM. So I always think about, man, I used to be a host there. Like I was a voice on there. You know, it's a crazy full circle moment, Jamie. And this is not it's not really public, but I'm now the station voice for MyFM right now.
Right now, you're the station voice. The man who left because he didn't want to be behind the mic is now behind the mic again and the official voice of the station.
Yeah, I'm the official voice for the station now. It's crazy, man. Crazy.
And in terms of the other things that are crazy to me is because you've got into this podcast game, you pivoted out of radio, and then 2025, this year, you were recognized with multiple awards, including for the Nixon and Nate podcast, Services to Broadcasting, and nominated for the Best Pacific Media Podcast. Is it all a bit surreal now, mate, that you look back from pivoting from radio into podcasting and you're now just cleaning up in the awards?
It is surreal. It is surreal. And it's so special as well. I think it's so special because there was a time, early 2000s, I didn't even know radio awards existed. For the mid-2000s, I knew radio awards existed, but I thought, man, we are so far away. Like you know, the Pacific Island thing and the new affair, I mean, man, we're so far away. We can't even compete, you know? So to now 2025 and to be there and to not only be nominated, but to win these awards and my name up on the board and that horrid photo that they picked for me and they put it up on the Jumbotron. But that's the thing that it's mind blowing, but really humbling and really special as well. That's definitely something that I look back on and just be like, man, insane.
And there's something that I found interesting in a previous chat you did where you said that something that you can't always play off, and that's celebrity. So a lot of people would see Nixon and Nate as being celebrities, and probably now especially, because they're probably the biggest names in media in New Zealand. Yeah. But the thing you said is that every good host or any good person that works in media has to have a mix of good chat and technical skills. Do you still stand by that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would say that Nixon and Nate, like their celebrity came from that good personality, that good chat that they have, the good at it, that all the celebrity comes from that. There'll always be a few celebrities here and there who just have that spark. But for the most part, yes, I still stand by that. You got to have a good story. You got to have some good chat, and that should always come first.
And is it impossible keeping Nixon out of the control booth with you doing the recordings? Because I've heard he's a bit of a jack of all trades. And I've actually had Ryan Foster, who used to be his producer, say that Nixon is probably one of the most talented people he's ever worked with, and said he was almost like a co-producer with him as well.
Thankfully, Nixon's not like that anymore. It's actually great how the podcast thing happens now. So Nixon and Nate, and this still amazes me as well to this day. So how we would prep for an episode recording, I would just put down bullet points, right, of whatever topics that are happening or whatever I think that they should be talking about, and I send it to them. Sometimes I don't even talk to them. And we get to the recording. Nate goes in the booth. Nixon goes in the booth. They yapper for a little bit. Hey, how you been? Yeah. I say, all right, we're recording. 3, 2, 1. Hit record, and I let them go. And they just perform like geez, they've read the prep sheet like for 4 hours. It's amazing, and they do that every week. But luckily, no, Nixon doesn't come and touch all the buttons. I think he quite enjoys it. I think that it's a bit therapeutic for him to just go in there and just talk about things that he can't talk about on the radio.
And do you think that's also the power of podcasting, in a sense where it does feel a little bit more unrated, in the sense where you don't have as much restrictions and you are allowed to be a little bit more open about things and not really have to restrict yourself to what the topics will be?
Yes, 100%. I'm all for, that's why I love it too, because I like things that are a bit edgy, or I like to present things that are a bit edgy, because it just gets people, interested. It excites them. So yeah, the podcast space, man, there's not too much that the boys say where I'll have to go, oh, let's not talk about that. I mean, there's a couple, but for the most part, man, I love it. I say, man, say whatever. If it's really bad, we'll cut it out.
And you were once told back in the day, in the early days of you starting, that you need to be able to play the game. What does that mean for you now, Louis? When you're looking back at your career and everything else and where you are now with Brown Street Media, podcasting and everything else, what does playing the game for you mean now?
I think you still got to play the game. It's about being switched on, and it's about being in tune with your surroundings. Unfortunately, you know, things are still out there that are roadblocks, you know, gatekeepers and funding and money and commercialization of things. These are still things that can trip you up out there. So I still very much stand by the play the game method, you know, to achieve what you want to achieve. If you have something that you really want to champion, whether it be Pacific music, whether it be freedom of conversation or speech or whatever it is, to get there, you got to play the game. You got to scratch a couple of backs. You got to rub a few egos. You may have to do something that you don't want to do every now and then, within reason I'm talking about. So, yep, playing the game is still very important, I believe.
And where do you see this expansion of Brown Street Media? Is there any upcoming projects that you have, or is there anything that's kind of on the cusp of being launched that you can chat about?
Probably not in detail, but there's two new podcasts that is going to come out under the Brown Street umbrella, but I'm also really wanting to branch off, and we're sort of starting these conversations now to branch off into film and TV side of things for Brown Street. That's kind of like a 5-year vision for me from now. But yeah, a few more podcasts on the way. One really cool one. Nate's going to be involved in this one as well, but it's going to be a podcast where people will look at it and be like, what the hell? It just doesn't make sense. So, yeah.
And is there any that you look in the sphere of the New Zealand podcast scene that you kind of think and you're like, man, I wish we were involved with those boys, or I wish I had jumped on that idea early on? Because I see New Zealand podcasting being incredibly strong at the moment.
Yeah, man. Yeah, like, honestly, the Morning Shift boys, they are probably, you know, top of the top at the moment. They definitely have set the bar in terms of podcasting. And, you know, this is the funny thing. So Nixon and Nate, you know, they're familiar with the Morning Shift boys as well. People seem to create this narrative, and I'm talking about audience, they create this narrative that there's some competition or some beef there because we're, you know, very similar and they know each other and that, which is definitely not the case. But, you know, I have been telling Nixon and Nate, I think for a year now, I said, we need to do a collab episode with these boys because it will go through the roof. And they're like, yeah, but call him. It hasn't seemed to happen. But, you know, the Morning Shift, the Between Two Beers podcast, is something that they kill as well. They kill. I don't know anybody personally on that, but I'm a fan of that podcast. But I wish there was something that we could do there. And there's a few other podcasts, you know, that I really like. And I just personally that I like, that I wish we had some sort of partnership with as well. But yeah, the Morning Shift thing and the Between Two Beers. Yeah, I would have loved a collaboration in some way.
Mate, that's all I hope for.
Yeah.
22 beers and the Morning Shift guys, yeah, ultimate combo. And I think, once again, like, as you've, as I love to mention, even my girlfriend has heard of you guys and the podcast as well, and it's hilarious because it's like, how does a New Zealand podcast transcend into an international market? And does that kind of still surprise you as well, that there are listeners from overseas that maybe tune in to what they have to say?
Yeah, it does. It does surprise me. But it's such an exhilarating feeling too, because, you know, when I look at the stats and that, and I see, you know, people in the States and Japan and the UK, I'm like, man, this is great. Like little old us in little old New Zealand. And just to think that people are listening to us and consuming our podcast in their country, it's crazy.
And of course, I have to ask the final question, Louis. We've had this big career, Brown Street Media, MyFM, NewFM, you starting at 17. For anyone who's jumping into the industry now, because I know it's massively different to what it was when you were growing up and certainly different from when I was in the industry as well.
Yeah.
What would be the advice for you to anyone who's thinking about starting and getting into this industry, whether it be podcasting, radio, or anything in between?
My number one, and this is so simple, my number one piece of advice that I tell everybody, listen. Listen to whoever's trying to teach you, whoever's trying to help you, whoever's trying to give you advice, listen to them carefully. It's just so important, because there's been people out there who have told me things back in the day, and I sort of just brushed it off. You know, I thought I was too cool for it. Come to, like, you know, 2020 or the 2020s, I think, that's what he meant. That's what she meant. That's what they meant when they were saying that. So if you're wanting to get into this industry and you reach out to somebody and they sort of tell you something, or you need to do this, or you need to do, or you should do this, listen to them. Listen, just listen.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at BeyondBroadcastPod or via email at beyondbroadcastpod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.